A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about car manuals and how they've become these enormous doorstops full of stuff nobody needs. And his solution is to curate a mini manual by printing out just the pages you actually reference. But the trick is making sure you're pulling the right document in the first place, because a Seat Ibiza in Spain isn't necessarily the same car as a Seat Ibiza sold in Mexico. And he's asking, what are the conventions for vehicle identification when you're hunting down technical documentation, and what trends are we seeing as manufacturers move this stuff online? There's actually a lot more here than just check your VIN.
Oh, this is one of those topics where the rabbit hole goes surprisingly deep. And I love that he framed it around the problem of document bloat first, because that's the thing nobody talks about. The average printed owner's manual today is something like 500 to 700 pages. The Ford F-150 manual alone is over 600 pages. Nobody reads that cover to cover.
It's the terms and conditions of the automotive world. You click, I agree, by putting the key in the ignition.
And most of it is liability hedging. Page after page of warnings not to drink the battery acid, don't operate the vehicle underwater, don't use the dashboard as a cutting board. The actual useful information, your tire pressures, your oil specification, your fuse box diagram, that's maybe 20 pages buried somewhere in the middle.
The curation idea makes sense, but the identification problem he's pointing at is real, and it's actually worse than most people realize. A car isn't just a make and model. It's a specific configuration that might share almost nothing with the same model, sold 300 miles away.
So let's start with the foundation here. The vehicle identification number, the VIN, is the universal key. It's been standardized globally since 1981 under ISO 3779, 17 characters, no letters, I, O, or Q to avoid confusion with ones and zeros. But here's the thing most people don't know. The VIN doesn't actually encode everything you need for documentation purposes.
I thought the VIN was supposed to be the definitive identifier.
It's definitive for the vehicle, but not for the documentation. The VIN tells you manufacturer, country of origin, vehicle type, engine type, model year, assembly plant, and a serial number. But it doesn't directly encode things like regional market specifications, emissions packages, or infotainment system variants. Those are often in what's called the PR codes, option codes, and they're usually on a sticker in the spare tire well or the service manual.
That's a Volkswagen Group thing, right?
It started with VW and Audi. But most European manufacturers use something similar now. PR stands for Productions Relevant. Production Relevant, and it's a three-digit alphanumeric code for every option on the car. Your Ibiza example is perfect here. A Seat Ibiza built for the Spanish market might have PR code 1AT for standard suspension, while the same-looking Ibiza for the UK market has PR code GO2 for sport suspension. Same model, same year, completely different maintenance requirements.
You pull the manual for Seat Ibiza 2024, and you're already in the wrong document before you've read a single word.
It gets worse. Some of these PR codes affect things you'd never think to check. Heated washer nozzles, battery capacity, brake pad compound, even the type of coolant. If you're doing your own maintenance and you look up the generic manual, you might be putting the wrong fluid in your car.
Which brings us to the first practical tip. Before you even touch a manual, you need to locate the vehicle data sticker. On VW Group cars, it's usually in the boot, the trunk, under the floor panel, or stuck to the inside of the service schedule booklet. On BMWs, it's in the driver's door jamb, along with the tire pressure chart. On Japanese cars, it varies wildly.
That sticker is your Rosetta Stone. It'll have the VIN, the engine code, which is different from what's in the VIN, by the way. The VIN only gives you a broad engine family. The engine code is specific to displacement, fuel type, and output. And then the list of PR codes or option codes. When you're looking up parts or documentation, the engine code plus the PR codes is what actually gets you to the right information.
The VIN is your library card, but the PR codes are the Dewey Decimal Number for the specific shelf.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And librarians, part specialists at dealerships, they know this. The rest of us are stumbling around with just the library card, wondering why we keep getting the wrong book.
Now, what about the trend piece of this? Daniel mentioned these manuals are increasingly moving online. What's actually happening there?
It's a mixed bag, and honestly, it's gotten worse before it's gotten better. Around 2018, several manufacturers started phasing out printed manuals entirely. Hyundai and Kia were early movers. They switched to what they called digital owner's manuals, accessible through the infotainment screen or a mobile app. By 2020, something like 40% of new cars in North America shipped without a full printed manual. You'd get a quick start guide, maybe 100 pages, and the rest was online.
Which on paper sounds reasonable. Save paper, keep the information updated, make it searchable.
Right, and the searchability is genuinely useful. If you need to know what that warning light means, you type yellow squiggly lines into the app and it finds the relevant section. That's faster than flipping through 600 pages. But the downsides are significant. What happens when the manufacturer discontinues the app? What happens when the car is 10 years old and the infotainment system no longer boots up? What happens when you're in a parking garage with no cell signal and your tire pressure warning comes on?
The right to repair crowd has been screaming about this for years.
They're not wrong. There was a big fight in 2023 when Subaru moved their service manuals to a subscription-only online portal. Independent mechanics had to pay something like $35 for a 3-day access pass to get torque specs and wiring diagrams. That's the dark side of the digital transition. It becomes a recurring revenue model instead of an information resource.
The trend is toward digital, but the implementation is all over the place. Some manufacturers are doing it well, some are doing it terribly, and some are using it as an excuse to lock down information that used to be freely available.
Let me give you the landscape as it stands right now. Toyota and Lexus have actually done a decent job. They maintain a public portal called Toyota Technical Information System, TIS, where you can access owner's manuals going back decades for free, no login required. You put in your VIN and it gives you the exact manual for your vehicle. Honda has something similar. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got manufacturers like Mercedes-Benz, who have moved almost everything behind a paywall, and their digital manuals are integrated into the MBUX infotainment system in ways that make them impossible to export or print.
If you own a 10-year-old Mercedes, you're in documentation limbo.
And this is where Daniel's curation idea becomes not just clever, but essential. If you can identify the right digital document while it's still available, and you pull out the 20 pages you actually need, you future-proofed yourself against the manufacturer changing their website, discontinuing the app, or going out of business.
Let's walk through the identification process practically. Someone buys a used car, let's say a 2021 Volkswagen Golf. They want to put together their curated mini manual. Step by step, what do they do?
Step 1. Locate the VIN. It's visible through the windshield on the driver's side, and it's also on the door jamb sticker. Step 2. Open the driver's door and photograph the entire sticker, not just the VIN, the whole thing. That sticker will have the type approval number, the engine code, and usually the paint code and interior trim code. Step 3, if it's a VW group car, lift the boot floor and photograph the PR code sticker. That's the gold mine. Step 4, go to the manufacturer's official owner's manual portal. For VW, it's usually at a URL like vw.com owners or the equivalent in your country, and enter the VIN. That should get you the correct manual for your market and model year.
That's doing a lot of work there.
It really is. Because here's where the region problem Daniel mentioned becomes critical. A VW Golf sold in Germany and a VW Golf sold in the United Arab Emirates might have the same VIN structure, but the UAE car probably has a different cooling system, different air filtration, possibly a different engine tune for fuel quality. If the VIN lookup on the German VW portal doesn't know about Golf specification vehicles, it might serve you the wrong document.
This is the I ordered a part for my Japanese market Toyota and got something that doesn't fit experience.
Which I've done, more than once, and it's humbling. So step 5, which most people skip, verify the manual you've downloaded matches your PR codes. Flip to the technical data section, usually in the back, and cross-reference the engine code and specifications with what's on your vehicle sticker. If they don't match, you've got the wrong document.
That's the kind of tedious cross-referencing that makes people's eyes glaze over, but it's exactly the thing that separates I have a manual from I have my manual.
This is where the enthusiast forums are invaluable. The VW Vortex forum, the Bimmerpost forums for BMW, the Miata.net garage section, these communities have already done the work of mapping which manual versions correspond to which market specifications. If you're unsure, someone on those forums has already asked the question and gotten an answer with part numbers.
The wisdom of the crowd, assuming the crowd is full of pedantic German car owners.
Which, historically, it absolutely is.
Let me ask you about a specific scenario. Say someone has a car that's been imported, a Japanese domestic market vehicle brought into the UK, or a European car imported to the United States under the 25-year rule. How do you even begin to find documentation when the car was never officially sold in your country?
This is the deep end. Japanese domestic market cars are a special challenge because the manuals are in Japanese, the VIN equivalent. They use a chassis number, not a full ISO. VIN is shorter and encodes different information, and the parts catalogs are often region locked. The workaround that most JDM owners use is to identify the closest equivalent export model and use that manual for the things that overlap: engine, transmission, chassis, while relying on translated Japanese documentation for the JDM specific features.
You end up with a Frankenstein manual from multiple sources.
Which is actually the smartest approach for any car, not just imports. The owner's manual covers operation. The service manual covers repair procedures. The parts catalog covers component identification. There are three different documents published by the manufacturer for different audiences, and none of them is complete on its own. A curated mini-manual should pull from all three.
That's a level of commitment that goes beyond check your tire pressures.
It does, but here's the thing. Once you've done it once, it's done. You laminate those pages, you keep them in the glove box, and for the rest of your ownership, you never have to Google what oil for 2021 Golf again.
Let's talk about the trends piece more broadly. Daniel asked what we're seeing among manufacturers. You mentioned the subscription model for service information. What else is changing?
The biggest shift in the last 2 years has been the integration of vehicle-specific documentation into the car's own telematics system. BMW and Mercedes are leading this. The car knows its own build sheet. It knows every option code, every software version, every hardware revision, and the onboard manual tailors itself automatically. You don't search for tire pressure and get results for 17 different wheel sizes. The car knows it has the 19-inch sport package and shows you only the relevant specification.
That's useful. It solves the identification problem at the source.
It does, and it's the one good argument for the fully digital approach, but it only works as long as the manufacturer maintains the software. A 2026 BMW iDrive system is going to be running on hardware that will be obsolete by 2035, and we all know how well car manufacturers handle long-term software support for aging models.
The same way they handle it for smartphones, which is to say, they don't.
And a smartphone is a $700 device you replace every 3 years. A car is a $40,000 asset you might keep for 15. The mismatch in software support expectations is enormous, and nobody's really talking about it.
There's also the question of who owns the manual. When it's a PDF you downloaded, you own it. When it's served through an app that requires authentication, you're renting access.
Manufacturers love rented access. Stellantis, that's Peugeot, Citroën, Fiat, Jeep, Chrysler. They've been pushing hard toward what they call connected services, which bundle navigation updates, manual access, and service scheduling into a subscription. The manual becomes a feature you pay for rather than a document you own.
Paying a monthly fee to find out your own tire pressure specification. That's the subscription economy eating its own tail.
It's the juicer of car ownership. You bought the fruit, but you have to keep paying to squeeze it.
What do you actually recommend? For the listener who wants to do what the prompt suggests, curate a small, useful manual for their car. What's the playbook?
First, do the identification work properly. Take photos of every sticker on your car. Driver's door jamb, under the boot floor, sometimes there's one in the engine bay on the strut tower. These are your ground truth. Second, download the manual from the manufacturer's official portal using your VIN, but don't stop there. cross-reference with enthusiast forums to confirm you have the right version for your market and specification. Third, identify the 10 to 15 pieces of information you actually need regularly and extract just those pages.
What's on that list?
Tire pressures, cold, oil specification and capacity, bulb types for every exterior light. Nobody remembers these, and you always need them when a bulb burns out at night in the rain. Fuse box diagram with fuse ratings. Jacking points, critical if you ever need to change a tire safely. Towing eye location, and the service interval schedule, what gets replaced at what mileage.
That's maybe 10 pages out of 600.
12 pages if you're economical. Print them, put them in clear plastic sleeves, keep them in the glove box or with the spare tire. Congratulations, you now have a more useful manual than the one the manufacturer spent millions of dollars producing.
The curated approach is better because it's actually fit for purpose.
There's a design principle here that applies way beyond cars. When you try to cover everything, you end up covering nothing well. The owner's manual is the canonical example. It's a reference work that's too intimidating to reference.
It's the encyclopedia in an age of search engines. Noble, impressive, and functionally obsolete the day it's printed.
Yet the information inside it is critical. That's the tension. You need the information, but the format makes it inaccessible. The curation approach solves that by separating the signal from the noise ahead of time, when you're calm and at a computer, rather than trying to do it at the side of the road with a flashlight in your mouth.
Let's talk about one more identification nuance. You mentioned engine codes earlier. Tell me about the difference between what's in the VIN and the actual engine code, because I think this trips people up.
The VIN's 8th character, positions 4 through 8, are the vehicle descriptor section, typically encodes the engine type, but it's a broad category. A VIN might encode 2-liter turbocharged 4-cylinder, but that same engine family could have 3 different output variants, each with different oil specifications, different spark plug gaps, different service intervals. The actual engine code, sometimes called the motor code, is stamped on the engine block itself and is far more specific. For VW Group, it's a 4-character code like CJXA or DKZA. For BMW, it's something like B48B2001. That code is what you need for parts ordering and service procedures.
That code is not in the VIN.
It's on the vehicle data sticker, and it's physically stamped on the engine. When you're pulling documentation, if the manual lists engine specifications, look for that code in the technical data section. If it doesn't match what's on your sticker, you have the wrong manual for your specific vehicle.
The VIN gets you to the right neighborhood, but the engine code and PR codes get you to the right house.
The right house is where the useful information lives. Everything else is just walking around the block hoping to spot a familiar landmark.
You mentioned enthusiast forums earlier. I want to dig into that, because there's a whole ecosystem of unofficial documentation that's often better than the official stuff.
The unofficial repair guides on forums are frequently more useful than the factory service manual, because they're written by people who have actually done the job in a home garage with normal tools. The factory manual assumes you have a 2-post lift and a full set of factory special tools. The forum guide says you can reach this bolt with 3 wobble extensions and a universal joint if you go in through the wheel well.
Which is the difference between remove engine and remove wheel? Reach around.
And there's a whole genre of YouTube mechanics who have built careers on this. The How to Change the Oil on a 2018 to 2022 Camry video that shows you exactly where the filter housing is and which size socket you need. That's documentation. It's not official documentation, but it's often better.
Does that create a reliability problem, though? If you're following a forum post from 2019 and your car is a 2023 with a mid-cycle refresh, that changed something subtle.
That's a real risk, and it's why the identification principles we talked about still apply. You need to verify that the guide you're following matches your specific model year and specification. Mid-cycle refreshes, what the industry calls a facelift, can change component locations, fastener types, fluid specifications. A 2022 and a 2023 might look identical from the outside, but have completely different oil filter housings.
The trust but verify approach. Download the forum guide, but cross-reference the part numbers against your VIN.
That's getting easier. There are now third-party services. Parts retailers like FCP Euro and Rock Auto have excellent catalog systems where you put in your VIN or your specific vehicle details, and they show you only the parts that fit your exact car. Even if you're not buying from them, their catalog is a free verification tool.
That's a practical tip worth underlining. Use parts retailers' VIN lookup as a free verification step, even if you never add anything to the cart.
It's faster than trying to navigate most manufacturers' own parts systems, which are designed for dealership parts departments and are about as user-friendly as a tax form.
Let's step back to the broader trend question. Where do you see this going in the next 5 years?
I think we're heading toward a bifurcation. On one side, premium manufacturers are going to push harder into the integrated telematics-driven model, where the manual is a feature of the car's operating system, tailored and always up to date, but locked to the vehicle and inaccessible from outside. On the other side, I think we'll see a growing push from right-to-repair advocates and regulators to mandate that independent access to service information remains available and reasonably priced.
Massachusetts passed a right-to-repair law for cars back in 2020 that forced manufacturers to make diagnostic data accessible through a standardized platform. Has that had any effect on documentation?
It has, and it's spreading. The Massachusetts law essentially forced manufacturers to provide the same diagnostic access to independent shops that they give to their own dealerships. That includes access to service procedures, wiring diagrams, and technical service bulletins. It went national in practice because manufacturers didn't want to build two different data systems for one market. The European Union has similar requirements under the Motor Vehicle Block Exemption Regulation.
The regulatory pressure is toward openness, while the commercial pressure is toward enclosure.
And the outcome is going to depend on which pressure is stronger in which market. In the EU, I'd bet on regulation winning. In North America, it's more of a toss-up, especially with the current administration's approach to regulation.
For the individual car owner right now, the practical advice is, don't wait for the industry to solve this. Take control of your own documentation while the information is still accessible.
Do it sooner rather than later. I've seen too many cases where someone buys a 10-year-old car, goes to download the manual, and discovers the manufacturer has reorganized their website and the PDFs are gone. Wayback Machine can sometimes help, but it's not reliable. If you have the right manual, save it locally. It's a small file and it's irreplaceable.
The digital equivalent of keeping a paper copy in the glove box.
Which is exactly what Daniel was advocating for in the first place. Print the pages you need. Paper doesn't crash, doesn't require a login, doesn't go offline, and doesn't stop working when the car battery dies.
There's something almost subversive about printing a PDF in 2026. A quiet act of technological defiance.
I love that framing. I have elected to own my information. Thank you very much.
Let's talk about one more identification layer that I don't think gets enough attention. The difference between market regions within the same country. You mentioned the UAE versus Germany example. But even within Europe, a car sold in Sweden might have a block heater as standard equipment, and the manual will include a whole section on using it that the Spanish market manual doesn't have. How do you verify you've got the right regional variant?
The PR code sticker is the definitive answer, but there's a quicker heuristic. Look at the owner's manual's cover or the first few pages. Most manufacturers print a market code or a publication number that indicates the target region. It'll be something like OM12345GB for Great Britain or OM12345NA for North America. The publication number is your quick check. If it doesn't match your market, you've got the wrong document.
Those publication numbers are usually printed in tiny type on the back cover or the inside front cover,
where nobody looks. It's like the copyright page of a book. All the bibliographic information is there, but readers skip right past it.
The manual's own manual.
And I'll add one more thing about regional variations that affect safety. Tire pressure specifications can vary by market not just because of different tires, but because of different regulatory requirements for ride comfort versus fuel economy. A car sold in Germany might have recommended pressures optimized for Autobahn stability. The same car sold in the United States might have pressures optimized for fuel economy testing. If you're using the wrong market's manual, you might be running pressures that are technically safe but not optimal for how and where you actually drive.
That's a knock-on effect most people would never think to check.
It's exactly the kind of thing that makes the identification step so important. You're not just looking for the manual for a 2021 Golf, you're looking for the manual for a 2021 Golf with engine code, DKZA, PR code suspension package, GO2, for the North American market, publication number OM, NA2021-04. That string of identifiers is what gets you to the right information.
It's like a bibliographic citation for your car.
Which is a wonderfully nerdy way to think about it, and I'm absolutely here for it.
What about electric vehicles? Does any of this change when there's no engine, no oil, no coolant in the traditional sense?
It changes what's in the manual, but the identification problem remains. EVs still have tires, still have brake fluid, still have cabin air filters, still have fuses. And they add new things, battery thermal management coolant, which has its own specification, and high voltage system safety procedures that are dangerous if you get them wrong. The manual for a Tesla Model 3 is thinner than an F-150 manual, but the identification requirements are the same. Different markets have different charging port standards, different software features, different regulatory compliance information.
Tesla doesn't even do model years in the traditional sense. They do running changes, so a Model 3 built in January might be different from one built in March.
Which makes the VIN even more important, because the model year convention barely applies. Tesla owners have learned to track their car's specific build date and software version like it's a rolling release Linux distribution. The documentation challenge is the same. You need to know exactly what you have before you can look up what to do with it.
Your car is a Linux distribution is both terrifying and accurate.
The over-the-air update model means your car's behavior can change overnight. The manual you downloaded 6 months ago might be out of date because a software update changed how a feature works. That's a documentation problem the industry has never had to deal with before, and I don't think anyone has solved it yet.
The curated manual for an EV might need version control.
Put a date on your printed pages. Downloaded June 2026, software version 2026. It feels absurd, but it's the only way to know whether your documentation still matches your vehicle.
We've covered a lot of ground. Let me try to pull it together. The prompt asks for general tips on making sure you're getting the right maintenance information for your specific car, and what trends we're seeing as documentation moves online. What's your summary?
For the identification piece, the VIN is your starting point, but not your destination. Photograph every sticker on your car, especially the one with PR codes or option codes. Use the engine code, not just the VIN engine digit, for parts and fluid specifications. Check the manual's publication number to verify market region. Cross-reference with enthusiast communities and parts retailer catalogs. And once you have the right document, curate it. Extract the 12 pages you'll actually need and keep them somewhere accessible.
For the trends.
The trend is toward digital delivery, which improves searchability and tailoring, but introduces long-term access risks. Some manufacturers are doing this well with free VIN-based portals. Others are using it as an opportunity to move documentation behind paywalls and subscriptions. Regulatory pressure is pushing toward openness, but commercial incentives push the other way. The smartest thing any car owner can do is download and preserve their documentation now, while it's available, on their own terms.
Your car is a $40,000 asset, and the manual is a 3 MB PDF. Protect the PDF like it's worth $40,000, because without it, the asset is a lot harder to maintain.
That's the line of the episode right there. Write that on the inside of your glove box.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
If a mantis shrimp's ability to see ultraviolet light were converted to a unit of distance, the shortest wavelength it can detect, about 300 nanometers, would be to a meter what the width of Tierra del Fuego is to the circumference of the Earth in the 1930s. That is, roughly one part in 3.3 million.
A lot of conversion steps.
I'm still trying to figure out who was measuring Tierra del Fuego in the 1930s. Thank you, Hilbert.
One thing I keep thinking about after all this, we talk about right to repair as a policy issue, but documentation is the foundation of it. You can mandate that manufacturers provide access, but if the documentation itself is a labyrinth of region-specific variants and paywalled portals, access in principle doesn't mean access in practice.
That's the gap between policy and reality. A law can say manufacturers must provide service information, but it doesn't say the information has to be organized, well, searchable, or available in a format that a human being can actually use. That's where the curation approach fills the gap. It's not waiting for the manufacturer to solve the problem. It's solving it yourself.
The document equivalent of trust, but bring your own tools.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact that I will be thinking about for the rest of the day.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review, or find more at My Weird Prompts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.